Bring the Jury. We are so excited today. We've got two amazing guest speakers. We're here with Kate and Casey. We're going to learn a little bit more about what they do in the legal spectrum. And we have missed you guys these past couple weeks. So we're so excited to not only be back, but be back with some special friends as well. I'm going to pass it over to the twins. I will not be joining us today, but I'll be behind the scenes fielding any questions that you may have, comments, feedback, and I'll be passing it along to this crew. So you guys take it away.
All right. Well, Kate and Casey, thanks for being part of our humble podcast. You are first ever guests, so thank you for that. I know you guys are really important, so it's always good to have some special people on. And Casey, we've had a good opportunity to see you recently. You and Luke did a little bit of a talk down at Charleston School of Law about mostly Casey's efforts with the Nicholas Cruz Parkland shooting and some other cases that you guys have done. Luke, you want to kind of introduce your friend Casey, or our friend Casey?
Yeah, well, it's Casey Secor, who's we started off together as public defenders in Richland County Public Defender's Office. And he was always an intense, passionate guy who just grew and grew as a lawyer. So I was glad to get to know him. And I watched him as he blossomed and really focused his career on capital defense, which basically, in my opinion, he was made for, because I have never known a more committed attorney. And so when you're talking about a situation where the stakes are as high as it can get, it helps to have that kind of guy on your side. So we've followed his career over the years. And then when he started Suzerain, obviously he was bouncing around a little bit between Louisiana and Florida and South Carolina, but just has done some really notable cases. Some were obviously probably post-Parkland. That was kind of just an eye-opening, amazing result. But unfortunately, in your line of work, the results sometimes are difficult to swallow. And it's not always where we want to be. But with folks like Casey and Kate, who we hope to get to learn a little bit more about, I think those results are probably fewer and fewer. So, you know, Casey, we had the pleasure of doing a trial with Casey a few years ago as a kind of a, you know, when you're in capital defense, I guess you don't always go to trial. You hope you're not in a trial. But every once in a while you have to practice. And so we had fun, practicing over in Edgefield on a case. But we like to keep Casey's picture in our conference room as we're trying to convince paying clients to hire us, and they say, who's that sexy man there that you're trying cases with? And it often helps us close the deal here, so thank you for that.
Yeah, that's good. But I don't know, maybe for this podcast, for some of our viewers, you know, we like to basically Monday morning quarterback various cases that are in front and center in the national news. So, so we talk about that, but I think this will be, it'd be nice if it was a little more educational, because I think there's a lot of misconception about, you know, what does it mean to defend a death case? How do you go about it? Why do you need an amazing mitigation specialist? What is mitigation? How does it help you in a capital case? So I'm sure a lot of the people that follow us in general, you know, because some of the cases we touch upon are death cases, like the Koberger case is a death case. And we've been talking about that. Not that we're going to Monday quarterback that, but some of our followers are very interested in that. So anyway, Casey, if you and Kate maybe want to talk about your organization, talk about why you felt there was a need for it. And I know lately you've been doing a lot of training, but maybe if you can kind of talk about what you're doing lately, and then we can kind of maybe talk a little bit about some of the things that are actually super critical when you start to begin defending a case that's been noticed for death.
Yeah, well, thanks for having us. We appreciate the opportunity. It's always good to see y'all and talk to you. I started Suzerain Capital Defense in 2016, and prior to that, I had worked for state-funded entities that did capital defense, like the South Carolina Commission on Indigent Defense, their capital trial division with Boyd Young and Bill McGuire. And then I worked for a while for the Louisiana Capital Assistance Center in New Orleans, which does death penalty defense throughout the state of Louisiana. And they're both wonderful offices. And I was fortunate to work with the people at both of those offices. But I grew increasingly frustrated with how much time was spent on funding issues. I never figured out exactly, but I would estimate approximately 25% of my time was spent dealing with funding issues, meaning trying to get funding approved for experts or for witness travel or for some sort of evidentiary testing. And I felt like 25% of my legal practice in capital defense was an unacceptable amount of time to be spending on issues that are pretty much unrelated to the defense of my client. Obviously, I need witnesses, I need experts, I need various testing done. But 25% of your practice is a very significant amount of time. And I was just frustrated by how much of that felt like it wasn't dedicated to actually advocating for my clients. So I started Suzerain in 2016 as a way of trying to do capital defense in a way that prevented me from having to spend so much time involved in bureaucratic red tape and funding issues. Providing pro bono services to capital defendants in various states. And recently, you're right, we have been doing a lot of consultations with teams throughout the country, primarily offices that do not have funding to pay for such consultations. And so based on the donors that contribute to Suzerain, we're able to actually go to these offices, people who have very limited funding in their capital defense practice, and offer training and consultation in various aspects of the cases. Capital cases are bifurcated, meaning in a capital case, there are two trials. The first trial, the jury determines whether or not the person is guilty or not guilty of first degree murder. And then if they are convicted, there's a penalty phase, a second trial, an entire second trial, but with the same jury. And during that, or at the conclusion of that penalty phase trial, the jury decides whether or not the person is sentenced to life without the possibility of parole or the death penalty. And so it is our job to paint a full picture of this guilty murderer in the event that they are convicted. Prosecutors in every kind of case, but particularly in death penalty cases, are interested in a very narrow version of the truth. They are interested in what the truth was at the moment that a person committed murder, at the moment that they pulled the trigger on a gun, at the moment that they wielded a knife. And they are completely disinterested in everything that led up to that moment and everything that has occurred after that moment. And of course, the moment the murder is committed is incredibly important. But what death penalty defense is about figuring out how a person could get to the point where they could have committed such a horrific act. What impairments and experiences they suffered throughout their lives that put them in a position where they could have made such a horrific choice, or perhaps affected them in such a way that choice making in the way that you or I think about it didn't exist for them. And that's really the crux of what capital defense is who is this person who did this thing? The state wants you to focus on them just as a murderer. It is our job to fill in the entire jigsaw puzzle of who they are as a human being, not only their lives, but the lives of their parents and the lives of their grandparents, to create a full and complete picture of who this human being is. And that's essentially the essence of what mitigation is. Kate O'Shea, in my opinion, is the best mitigation specialist in the United States. She has been to trial 17 times, I believe. And I will let her speak to that more because she does a much better job of describing what mitigation is. But that's essentially what the essence of capital defense is.
Well, good. I think that's very helpful for our viewers. Yeah, Kate, if we could just let you kick off and talk about mitigation and the way you describe it and how you go about finding it so that it can be used to our clients' benefit.
Sure. Yeah, and I think Casey did a great job of explaining mitigation. And it's really about answering the questions, right? People look at a horrible crime and they ask, how could someone do this? Why would someone do this? And there are always answers, and it's never, and even in my considerable experience, it's never just that they wanted to. It's never like they came from a nice home and they had a nice life and everything was going well for them and they had other opportunities, but murder was the path that they chose. That person might exist, but I haven't met him yet if he's out there. So what we do is look at a person's life, their entire background, and we, you know, we collect their records. We talk to people. We start with family members. We sort of start in the middle with family members and then fan out to friends, neighbors, teachers, coaches, social workers, people who we find through the records. And for me, when I am getting to know a client, I don't ask them, were you abused? I don't ask them, just generally tell me about your childhood. What I want to do with my clients is help them to understand that they are who they are because of things that have happened to them along the way. And I want them to get to a place where they look back at their lives and think about why they are in the position that they're in and why they did the things that they did. And then they sort of more organically are able to help me help them understand, you know, was it sexual abuse? Was it poverty? Was it a lack of role models? So I don't like to just sort of go in and kick the door down and say, tell me all about the terrible things that happened to you in your life. I think it's important to help a client sort of get there on their own.
Right. Kate, what kind of, I mean, I could ask this almost as easily with Casey as you, but how do you find yourself doing the job that you do, which is, you know, one of the most stressful, time consuming, you got no fans, no one's really saying, oh, Kate O'Shea, Kate O'Shea. I mean,
they could be, but
I mean, Casey is, and people in the close kind of death penalty circles are very appreciative of your work. But like, how do you get into it? Number one, how did you personally get into it? And how do you sustain this level of commitment to something that is so difficult for like the public to conceptualize? Like, well, the state wants to put someone to death because they killed someone in a really bad way. Isn't what's wrong with that? And like, but it's really, really bad, right? Like, so like that person, right? So like, and also with what you do, and this is a really 3- and 4-part question now, but how do you carry that burden? Because I know you have to really emotionally connect often with families and communities, and where something really bad has happened, and it's just emotional toll. How do you deal with that?
That was a very compound question. I'll try to start at the beginning. So I spent the first several years of my adult life actually working as a Harley mechanic. I come from a pretty long line of lawyers. My mom is a longtime public defender. My grandfather was a lawyer. His brother was a judge. His two sons were lawyers. But I resisted it for a long time. I used to go to court with my mom when she was in misdemeanors, and I would sit there for hours and just be like, God, this is so boring. I never want to do this. So I didn't go to law school, but I was a mechanic for 9 years. And I got to a point after the first several years where I was just sort of feeling unfulfilled. And I was in college and sort of trying on different hats. And my mom was working in the public defender's office in Fort Myers, Florida, doing capital work. And she ended up meeting a guy named Terry Lenneman, who was a lawyer from Miami, when there was a really large multi-co-defendant case. And they kind of got to know each other just waiting around for people to show up for depositions. And he convinced her to leave the public defender's office and go into mitigation. So I'd started working for her just sort of on the weekends here and there, just, you know, reviewing records and talking to her about her cases, and pretty quickly decided that it was what I wanted to do. So in 2009, I left my job, went to work for my mom full time, finished college. I worked for my mom until 2015, and I've been in private practice ever since. I got involved in the Cruz case a couple of days after it happened. The Broward County Public Defender's Office called and asked me to take the case, and I initially really didn't want to. I didn't want anything to do with a high profile case. I didn't want to go back to South Florida. I was working in the rural parts of North Florida where I was much happier. But I felt compelled to take the case because the reason I do this work, it's not that my opposition to the death penalty is about retribution. I don't have a problem with the, you know, retribution as being a function of our justice system. I don't have a problem with justice. What I have a problem with is a system of government that executes people while willfully ignoring its own role in the factors that contribute to violent crime. And I thought that that would be true almost nowhere more than in the Parkland case. There was just this, and I knew before I even got involved in the case that there would be a story that started when he was very young and included just a lot of failures, individual failures, systemic failures. And I knew that the event was very avoidable. And so I felt compelled to take that case because I wanted to contribute to the national conversation around school shootings and mass violence in a meaningful way. And I don't know if I accomplished that the way that the narrative always was around the trial, but I continue to try to take the lessons that we learned from that case and teach people around the country, whether it's Capital Defenders or anybody that'll listen really to us talk about those things. And that was what compelled me to join Suzerain. Casey and I worked very closely together on the Cruz case. I remember he joined the case in 2019. And he called me one day and said, listen, I just want you to know I'm here. And you can ask me to do anything. No task is too small. Whatever you need, it's you call me and I'll be there. And I was like, oh, buddy, you're going to regret saying that. And I think he still does. And so, you know, Casey was, he would spend nights, weekends, you know, traveling with me, being out in the field, just getting our asses kicked day in and day out. And I was really moved by his commitment to, you know, to the case and to capital defense in general. So when the case was ending, obviously I was very much looking forward to putting the case in my rear view, but I didn't like the idea of my professional relationship with Casey ending. So we talked and I ended up joining Suzerain and we formed this capital case consultation team, which has enabled me to take the lessons that I've learned and the skill set that I have from the last 15 years of being in private practice and having tried, as Casey said, 17 cases and share that skill set with other mitigation specialists. So I feel like I'm able to sort of make more of a difference to and cast a wider net than I can just through direct representation because I can only have so many clients on my plate at a time. Did I answer all four of your parts?
Yeah. Good job.
I think you missed the mental health component of the question.
Yeah, it's there's not an easy answer. And I think Casey would agree with me that none of us were exactly taking perfect care of our mental health, especially throughout the trial portion of the Cruz case. But, you know, you have to learn to compartmentalize and you have to have an outlet. I volunteer at an animal rescue on the weekends. That's how I sort of find my work-life balance. I would sometimes on the way home from court on Fridays, because I live about 3 hours away from Broward County, and I had to drive across this stretch of road that kind of runs across the bottom of Florida called the Alligator Alley. And I would routinely just drive home on Friday nights and put the windows down and turn the radio up and just scream profanities into the Everglades until I was hoarse. So that was something that actually helped me a little bit during the Cruz case, but I think you just have to, you have to make room for yourself in these things and you have to, you know, take the little victories where you can.
Window. I just, in my mind, this whole time I had you on a vintage motorcycle, just ripping down the road. No,
it's still in the garage. It's not, I did build my own motorcycle. It is in the garage, but it's not very practical.
Yeah.
Going to and from court.
Nice. Someone once described, and I know we're talking a lot about the Cruz case, and someone very smart once described it as the Super Bowl of death penalty cases. Basically, so much press, so much pressure, so much, you know, kind of willingness to let even like death penalty, anti-death penalty advocates to kind of like, well, you know, this guy's pretty bad, right? So after securing a life, you know, sentence, life verdict, what's Suzerain looking like after this? And I know from just being friends with Casey that, you know, I think Casey, your role initially in that case was kind of supposed to be more limited, like, you know, jury selection,
And then it kind of morphed into much more. And of course, you're willing to do it. But are things in the for your entity all hunky dory? Is it are lessons learned? Where does Suzerain go after kind of getting being involved in the Super Bowl of death penalty cases?
Well, I think when I initially formed Suzerain in 2016, I believe that I overestimated the extent to which people really care about the death penalty. I think that there are a lot of very intelligent people who believe that it is wrong, believe that it is barbaric, and believe that it is shameful that the United States still has the death penalty. But I don't think a lot of those people are willing to actually do anything about it. I think doing something about it is very unpopular. Suzerain has a very small core group of very dedicated funders to whom I'm incredibly grateful. But we have always been on a shoestring budget. We have always been on the verge of unsustainability ever since we began. And when I agreed to take part in the Cruz trial, I did not do it for any reason. I did not do it because I thought that it would be good for the organization. I didn't think it would be good for me. Those factors didn't come into my mind. They weren't part of my analysis. But I did, after the trial concluded, I did sort of think that perhaps it would have a positive impact on Suzerain as an organization in terms of the extent of people who are interested in contributing to the work that we do. And I could not have been any more wrong about that. There are some people that had been contributing to Suzerain for many years who actually wrote to us and said that they were stopping contributing because of the fact that Nick got life without parole, which begs the question, you know, did they even have any idea what the organization was doing? I mean, we're incredibly transparent about what we do. So I'm not sure what those people thought, but it is a little bit frustrating and disheartening to feel like you can pour yourself into something that difficult and achieve an outcome that is not a victory in the sense that anybody thinks about victories. I mean, when he was sentenced to life, there was no high-fiving, there was no yelling and cheering, there was no drinking, nothing. We walked from the courthouse back to the public defender's office in complete silence. We walked through the door of the public defender's office. A couple people on the team just burst into tears. I went into an empty office with the lights off and closed the door and just sat there in the dark for hours. I don't even remember seeing Kate after that point. I mean, it's not the type of thing that you celebrate, because in every case that you quote unquote win, the person goes to prison for the rest of their lives if you're in the penalty phase of a capital case. And that is tragic and sad. I mean, obviously I would never let Nick out of prison. He needs to be punished for the rest of his life. But it is not the type of thing that you go around boasting about or that brings you joy, because there is so much pain and there is so much trauma, and it will go on forever and ever. And there is nothing that you can do to prevent that cycle of trauma that people experience. And I mean what I mean about those people. I mean the people who were victims of Nick's crimes and the people that love those people, their family members, their parents, their siblings, their cousins, their friends. The ripple effects of what he did are just unfathomable. So the organization has a very strong core group of supporters, but we are very limited in terms of our financial resources. I and Kay Thompson, who's our director of operations, have made really significant personal sacrifices to years. And I'm not complaining about that. I mean, I wish it were otherwise, but it is something that we have chosen because we believe in it so much. And yes, you're right. The Cruz trial, I was originally supposed to be brought in just to train the team in jury selection. But because of the magnitude of the trauma associated with working on that case, there were several team members that left the team or even left the public defender's office. And ultimately, Melissa McNeil, who's the lead counsel, asked me to be fully on the team with her and try the case with her, which I ultimately agreed to do. But no, it was never my intention to do so. But the positive of having done so is that I got the opportunity to work with Kate, and I learned a tremendous about mitigation work and about capital defense that I never knew and never would have known without the opportunity to work for her. So for that, I am grateful. And there is something about trying a case that's that long and that traumatizing that I think sort of helps you going forward, because it's unlikely to ever encounter a case as bad as that ever again. So I guess that's something that I'm glad is behind me. I obviously wish that it had never happened and that I didn't need to be involved in it. But it does feel like something that has given me a level of courage and confidence that I probably never would have had absent a particular case.
Yeah, we sometimes joke about being in quote trial shape, and obviously a non-death case, particularly in South Carolina, I mean, it's a week and a half if it's really involved. Sometimes the whole Murdoch saga was very unique, but it kind of pales in comparison. But if you don't, if we do a case for like a murder case for like a week, or even if it goes into like Monday or Tuesday of the following, and we haven't done it, you know, one in like half a year, you just definitely feel like your ass has been kicked just because of the constant adrenaline and stress. So when you guys were slogging it out for so long, I just couldn't imagine, because, you know, it just has to be exhausting. So I don't know how you pick yourself up day after day after day and do that. But anyway, I commend you. But I don't know if you had any secrets. I mean, for the normal lawyers out there, but I don't know.
To me, it's all, and I've felt this way ever since we were at the public defender's office in Richland County together. I find that the most difficult part of trial is walking through the doors of the courtroom on the first day. That is the moment that I come the closest to thinking, or to thinking to myself, I should fake an illness or something. Like, that is the most horrifying moment of the entire process to me. And one of the reasons why I like working with you, Luke, and Brian, is because I experience a level of confidence that I cannot find in myself. And I've always felt that way about the two of you. And that's why I was drawn to both of you when we worked together, is because you carried yourself with such confidence, and not arrogance, but just but a high level of competence. You knew that you knew what you were talking about, and you were committed to your clients, and you were comfortable in your skin, and you were prepared, and you believed that you could persuade people. And I've had the opportunity to meet your folks before, and I think that people like you, good people like the two of you, almost inevitably always come from good families and good parents who instilled values in you. And so I'm just saying all that because I always found it so hard to just walk into a courtroom. And once I did, with people that I trusted and looked up to, like when I was with y'all, I felt like I could get into a comfort zone and just sort of hold my breath until the trial was over. In Cruz, it was similar in that I had a lot of faith in the team, and particularly having Kate there gave me a tremendous amount of confidence that I wouldn't have otherwise had. And going into the courtroom on the first day with all the traumatized victims' family members there was very difficult. But getting past that initial day and getting to that point where you feel like you're in a stride and just kind of holding your breath, I never imagined that I could do it for, what was it, 7 months? Is that how long it took?
Yeah.
7 months.
Yep. Crazy.
But I just sort of, I lost track of time. And I, like Kate, would spend a lot of time, you know, driving at night and would, you know, listen to bands like Rage Against the Machine and Pearl Jam just to try to rid my mind I had from that case. But it's something that you can't ever shake. I see images from that case in my dreams at night, and even daydreams during the day involuntarily. And I think every day about the lives that Nick extinguished and about the people that loved those people who he killed. And I have intense levels of anger towards Nick. And I've told him how much I hate what he did, but I refuse to allow myself to hate him because he is such a terribly broken person through no fault of his own. And so I think one of the things that sustained me through that trial was the fact that there was literally no one on the planet that cared about him at that point, certainly, but arguably from the day that he was born. And I take a great deal of pride in standing up for people that society couldn't care less about and is willing to condemn to death. And so probably above all else, what sustained me is just my belief in how important it is that people like Nick have an advocate for them, regardless of how horrifying their conduct.
Casey, I want to ask you a version of a question you got recently with us. For the folks, the two or three folks that are out there listening right now, we had the pleasure of having Casey come to the College of Charleston and speak to a law school club that is all about the death penalty or anti-death penalty club. So these are all students who are very eager in learning about the death penalty. Presumably, they're not necessarily advocates for it. It's anti-death penalty. But even those folks, after listening to the presentation, I think Casey got one question that probably would be the type of question that maybe some of our viewers might ask is, you know, we talk about obviously mitigation in, you know, once you start digging, you uncover a common theme of kind of trauma in our clients. But I remember there was one young woman who kind of stood up and said, well, Casey, I mean, what do you say to folks? Like, you know, I could kind of see it in herself. She was like, well, I've had something fucked up in my life, you know, but I haven't gone out and killed anybody. So like, how do you explain that? You know, like, you know, why does he not deserve to get the death penalty when I've, you know, kind of pulled myself up by the bootstraps and made a successful go of it? So maybe can you touch on that for some of our viewers that might be wondering the same thing, and kind of how do you deal with questions like that or concepts like that? Because you might get those concepts too from prosecutors, obviously, as you're trying to negotiate a possible life deal before trial, even judges, when they are being asked to sign some funding order, you know, for the Parkland shooter. So can you touch on that?
Yeah, and I think that that's sort of the crux of what capital defense is all about, because you're absolutely right. And there's a lot of people that have terrible, traumatic childhoods that don't go on to hurt anybody else. And so there is not a causal link between having a bad childhood and committing murder. Absolutely, unequivocally, that is not the case. But anybody who has committed a capital murder, and frequently just a non-capital murder, will have a very traumatizing life history. And I think one of the most quintessential examples of that is the case that, Luke, you and I worked together on in 2014 and 2015. I was appointed to represent a young black man in South Carolina charged with shooting and killing one white police officer and shooting another white police officer. And I needed a co-counsel. And when I needed or had the opportunity to get a co-counsel on that case, Luke was the first person that I thought of. And I worked very hard to make sure that Luke would be able to be on that case with me because of I knew how much he would bring to the case, and I knew how much confidence that I would derive from his presence. But that young man, when he was 2 years old, his father murdered his mother. And so on the same day in his childhood. He lost his mother and his father because his mother was murdered and his father went to prison for the rest of his life. And he was bounced around between various family members. And there were some family members that loved him and that did their best, but they had their own children. They had their own marriages and relationships. They had jobs. They had struggles in their own life. And our client, Stefan, and as a consequence of just sort of drifting around, he ultimately, as he became a teenager, became the perfect prey for gangs, because gangs prey on people who don't have a sort of a core value system based in a family unit. And so Stefan was the perfect person for a gang because the gang became the family that he never had. And so during those important years of adolescence and mid to late teen years, all of the things that a young person needs to be instilled with, like hard work and commitment to school and compassion and helping others and all the types of things that we try to instill in our children, he was instead getting fed the mentality of the gang that had taken him in. And he was indoctrinated to profoundly mistrust law enforcement in every shape and form. He had some negative interactions with law enforcement, which additionally colored his perception of law enforcement. And he just had a continuing cycle of traumatization in his life. And he had no one to turn to. He had no base to return to, no father, no mother, no people that had the moral and the legal obligation to care for him and to shape him into a positive human being. And so on the night that he was arrested, he had been involved in an altercation with somebody and had fired a gun at them. And then later on, when the police were looking for the person who had fired the gun, they pulled him over and he ended up shooting two of the police officers and killing one of them, a man who had three young sons and a wife. Just a really horrific case. And you know, the whole thing that we focused on in that case was not that the loss of his mother and father on the same day when he was 2 years old, that's not an excuse for murder. It's not a justification for murder. It's not a defense to murder. We don't ever offer mitigation as an excuse, justification, or defense. It is none of those things. If you have an excuse, justification, or defense, you would be not guilty. Stefan was very guilty. There's dash cam videos of him shooting these police officers. But the question becomes, do we as a society condemn to death somebody who is traumatized and deprived to the extent that Stefan was? Do we take a person whose mother was murdered by their father when they were 2 years old and condemn them to death row as if we cannot in any way understand how a person that traumatized could go on to hurt somebody else in the future? I think we all know collectively, you hear things like the apple doesn't fall far from the tree and things like that. And no one requires an explanation of what that phrase means. Everybody knows what it means. And another version of that is that hurt people hurt people. It's as simple as that. People who have been harmed and traumatized by others in their lives, unfortunately, will frequently go on to do it to other people. And again, it's not an excuse, justification, or defense, but we have to ask ourselves as a society, if we are the sophisticated society that we claim to be, are we going to condemn to death people like that, that never had a chance in life? And I would like to think that if this country is what we claim it is, that the answer to that question would be no. Unfortunately, still we have this practice of capital punishment in this country. We are one of the only sophisticated democracies on the planet that still has the death penalty. All of Western Europe has abolished the death penalty. The rest of the Western Hemisphere has abolished the death penalty. So it is a stain on our moral reputation. And frankly, it interferes with our ability to accomplish other things, because there are countries that will not come to the table with us on other issues because of the fact that we still use capital punishment. And it is an absolutely unnecessary tool. We have life without the possibility of parole, so society can be protected by removing murderers from society. The death penalty is nothing other than a contemporary version of a lynch mob. It is used by politicians as a way to garner public attention in the lead up to their reelection campaigns, and it is nothing other than that. It couldn't be any less necessary. It's also a catastrophic waste of money. It is exponentially more expensive to execute somebody than it is to put them in prison for the rest of their lives. And so I am hopeful that at some point in my lifetime, we will put an end to it, but it's going to take an awful lot of work.
I got a question for Kate with her experience. And, you know, as far as I know, you guys are in the Southeast. We're in the Southeast. We're all in the Bible Belt. Do we feel like people's religious beliefs, you know, is it helpful, Kate? Is it more difficult when you, like, Old Testament folks that are trying to conceptualize, like, we'll need somebody like Nick Cruz, who is, like, you know, a lazy thinker, as Casey has said, may think, well, there's just evil people that just need to be put down. So people that are deeply religious in the South and the Southeast, is it harder, or can you kind of use their religious upbringing to kind of help them come around? Kate, tell me about some of your thoughts on that.
Well, if I could answer that question and your last question a little bit, you were asking about people who sort of pull themselves up by the bootstraps and say, well, I had a hard childhood and I didn't kill anybody. And there are obviously millions or billions of people out there that have hard childhoods and thankfully never grew up to become murderers. And the fact is that no two people have the same experience. Even two children who grew up in the same home don't have the same experience. And there are resiliency factors that we don't necessarily understand. Some of them are about cognitive abilities. Some of them are about just temperament. And I used to run into this a lot when I worked in Miami. I worked in areas like Little Haiti and Liberty City, that they were these, you know, low socioeconomic areas where I'm working in the projects, and my clients frequently would have large families, lots of siblings. And there would always be one sibling that somehow, you know, quote unquote, made it out, got out of Miami, were successful. And it was always, they joined the military. And if I ask that sibling, why is it that you were able to get out of your situation? Was there someone along the way that helped you? The answer is always yes. There's always a teacher, a coach, a parent, a neighbor, someone takes an interest in a child and helps them on their path. And the other thing that we can't put our finger on is just luck, right? Like, some people are just unlucky. And I think a lot of people don't realize how many times throughout their life they were a couple of bad decisions away from death or prison. So I don't think it's fair to just say that not everyone who has a bad childhood grows up to be a murderer. Of course not, because there would be nobody left on earth to murder if that was the case. And, you know, as to your question about people's religion, when we have jurors who believe that everyone who commits a murder should get the death penalty, those people are not eligible to sit on a death penalty jury. And it's interesting when somebody comes in and we ask them, what are your feelings about the death penalty? And they start with, well, I'm Christian. I always hold my breath, because it's like that could go one way or the other. Some people say, well, I'm Christian and I read the Bible and an eye for an eye. And then other people say, well, I'm Christian and I remember the story where they were going to stone the woman and Jesus said not to, so I could never vote for the death penalty. So I'm not sure that people's religion one way or the other can necessarily bring them around.
Okay, I guess I was thinking more about victim outreach aspects.
Okay.
You got a victim family member who has deep moral beliefs, maybe based on their upbringing in Christianity or some other religion, and they are Old Testament, like, you know, Southern Baptist or whatever. And they kind of I guess I'm more interested in the challenges that you or your team and with your experience have dealt with deeply Old Testament religious people versus maybe dealing with a Catholic who thinks, you know, I don't think, you know, we're eye for an eye here, that, you know, we're opposed to the death penalty. Do you have any insight into that kind of stuff?
So if a victim's family member wants our client to get the death penalty, we absolutely respect their feelings. We would not approach a victim's family member and try to change their mind. It is important to us that the victim's family members are educated about the process. And oftentimes we find that they are not. I worked on a case recently. It was a resentencing. It was a crime that happened in 2005. There were four co-defendants. One of them took a plea and snitched on everybody else. The other three went to trial separately and were sentenced to death. All of them, including my client, came back for resentencings. The first one went to trial and got life. And then it was my client's turn. So this is the fifth time that this victim's family has been to trial and sat through all the horrific evidence of their loved ones being murdered. While the jury was out, I went over to them and I said, I had to come over here and tell you, I'm so sorry for everything that you've been through and everything that you continue to go through. And I just want you to know that despite us up there advocating for our client, we don't ignore you or your pain. And we just want you to know that we think about you. And they were amazing people, and they hugged me, they embraced me, and they talked about forgiveness, and they had forgiven my client and forgiven all of them decades ago, which was just absolutely incredible to me, how anyone could have sat through the kind of graphic evidence. This is a case where two elderly people were buried alive. And so their family had sat five times and looked at the crime scene photos and heard the medical examiner testimony. And they had gotten to a place of forgiveness, and they were people of strong faith. Now they had forgiven him for themselves, but they still believed that the death penalty was the appropriate punishment for him. And all we could do is respect that. So if someone has a strong religious belief one way or the other, we certainly would not try to change their minds. But in that particular case, they told me this, that we want to tell Michael that we forgive him. Is there a way that we can do that? And I said, yes, of course, you can speak at sentencing. Just tell him. And he can speak at sentencing, and he wants to apologize to you. And no one had told these people in 18 years that they had a right to speak at sentencing. And this was the fifth time. So they spoke at sentencing. My client got up. He expressed remorse. He apologized to them. They stood up in the courtroom. They told him that they forgave him. And I mean, it was a moment that will stay with me for the rest of my life. It was beautiful. There wasn't a dry eye in the courtroom. When the final co-defendant went to trial, she ended up getting a life sentence, and they got up and spoke at her sentencing as well and told her that they forgave her. So there was this catharsis that wouldn't have been there if we had not made the effort to make sure that the victims' families knew what they had a right to do.
Thank you for that. That's very interesting, and kudos to you. But I got a question that's been bubbling up in my mind for a while, so I want to ask you about it and then ask you a follow-up. It won't be four parts, but it'll basically be two parts. So once Casey invited me on to Stefan's case, and I got exposed to training and jury selection and went out to Colorado and Boulder, and the Colorado method developed by those folks out there, Dave Wymore and company, to me just kind of really blew my doors off a little bit in a very kind of socially scientific way of selecting jurors. That it appears that prior to that, you could have great lawyers that were just, you know, if you don't have the right way to select a jury, you could have Clarence Darrow just banging his head against the wall, and he's going to get death verdict after death verdict. And you can have someone like Kate, who's got all this great, mitigation, but if you got a jury full of impaired individuals who don't want to hear what she has to say or to present, then you're just not going to win. So what I want to know is, I will say this, it seems like that method for selection just revolutionized things to me, because it seems to kind of, in a very intense but formulaic way, kind of allow jurors to really reveal who they are in a somewhat isolated, targeted way,
whether there's someone who might never care, you know, to listen to Kate and understand mitigation, or someone who might be open to it. So one, I like for y'all to talk a little bit about that. How you've seen that work across the country? Is that something that Suzerain teaches? But two, I've been wondering, because when we picked a jury in Stefan's case in Aiken, South Carolina, and we're dealing with very experienced prosecutors, they had no idea how to really combat what we were doing. And we were getting rid of killers left and right, getting people that were very open to the types of things that Kate might show them about a case, and it saved the day for Stefan. But are y'all finding, as you go throughout the country and as time has passed a little bit, that are prosecution teams doing anything to combat that? Is there some kind of like reverse Colorado method school of like fascism where they like teach some kind of way to combat the Casey Secors of the world, or you just find that they're just kind of plowing, you know, forward as normal and just hoping that terrible facts will be on their side?
Well, the only state that I'm aware of that has really, at least to some extent, has tried to combat the way in which we conduct jury selection is Florida. But they have not done a very good job of it. And the reason they haven't done a good job of it is because proper constitutional voir dire in capital cases is based in Supreme Court precedent. And so the prosecutors in Florida and other places like to try to suggest to judges that what we're doing is some sort of trick, and that it's somehow inappropriate or improper or impermissible, which couldn't be further from the truth. It is grounded entirely in Supreme Court precedent, first and foremost, the case of Morgan versus Illinois. And the focus of our jury selection in capital cases, and frankly, what our focus should be in jury selection in every case, is not picking a jury. In death penalty cases, during jury selection, we do not try to pick jurors. We focus exclusively on getting rid of people who are not open to our defense theory, meaning people who do not believe that the concept of mitigation, a guilty murderer's character and background and life experience, should in any way influence the punishment that he or she receives. So it is our job in jury selection to identify who those people are who do not believe in mitigation and think that all murderers should get the death penalty, and get them excluded for cause, because legally they are excluded for cause. And what that means is that if a person has that belief system and we identify it in court, the judge is supposed to thank them for their jury service and send them home, because you cannot be a juror on a death penalty case if you think that a person who commits capital murder should automatically get the death penalty. Those types of people, understandably, should not be on a death penalty jury, because then why would you have a trial? You already know what decision they're going to make. You've just impaneled a lynch mob that's just going to sit there and wait till the evidence is over and then sentence the person to death. We have to identify the people who, despite the fact that they can accept that a person has committed a horrifying capital first-degree murder, can see how that person could still be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole based on their mitigation. So, for example, in Stefan's case, it was our job to get rid of people who were unequivocally going to sentence him to death and try to protect those people who even knowing that he committed this terrible crime, could see to a point where they could theoretically, potentially sentence him to life without the possibility of parole. And so, frankly, I think that we need to do that in all kinds of criminal cases. A lot of voir dire that you see in criminal cases in this country is educational voir dire, where we say to people, well, you understand that a person has a right to not testify during a trial, and that against him. He has a constitutional right to remain silent. And every juror that you say that to in open court is going to nod along and say, yes, I agree with that. I agree that a person does not have to testify. I agree it shouldn't be held against them. And then as soon as you're done saying that to them, they're going to revert right back to the person they've been for their entire lives, which is somebody that holds it against a person who doesn't testify in their own defense in court. Because most people, if you're driving down the highway on, you know, from Columbia to Charleston on 26, and you see somebody pulled over on the side of the road and they're standing behind their car in handcuffs, no one thinks to themselves, oh, look at that innocent man. Everybody in the world thinks to themselves, like, that son of a bitch got caught doing some bad shit. That's how the brain works. And so what we should be doing, and when we're picking juries in cases, and we want to talk about the presumption, I mean, the right to remain silent, the fact that you don't have to testify in your own defense, we should never say, it should never be educational and say, you agree, you know, waving your flag in this country, you have the right to remain silent. You don't have to testify. Everyone's going to agree to that. What you should do is say to a group of jurors, don't you think if someone's being tried for a criminal offense and they don't testify, it's because they're hiding something? And a lot of people would be like, yes, that's exactly what I think. And you say, thank you. I appreciate you sharing that with me. Is that something you felt for a long time? Uh-huh. And that's just sort of based on how you were raised and how you view the world. Uh-huh. And then that person can't be on the jury. They're going to get excluded for cause. And what you're going to be left with, hopefully, are all the people that recognize that there are plenty of reasons why a person might not testify in court when they're being tried for a criminal offense. I heard a Florida lawyer describe it beautifully recently. He said, you know, when I stand up to talk to a jury, I'm nervous and I have nothing at stake. And you couldn't imagine how anxiety inducing it would be to be the guy actually on trial, not only to speak publicly, but to take the stand and be attacked by a prosecutor and have every bad thing you've ever done brought up and called a liar, no matter what you say. And that makes sense, but it takes a lot of insight to get to the point where you can understand that about humanity. It's very easy to just be like, well, if you don't testify, it's probably because you're guilty and you're hiding something. And people will admit to that. People love to admit their condemnation of other human beings. And that's what voir dire should be. It should be like a Trump rally where you ramp everybody up and everybody throws themselves for who they are, and then they all get excluded for cause.
That's right. I have a very fond memory of in Stefan's case in the middle of jury selection, because Casey, for any viewers out there, is very good at this. And Judge Newman, who some of our viewers know is the judge in the Murdoch case, was an African-American judge as well, and he knew he didn't like what Casey was doing. And it was just jurors getting kicked left and right for cause. And so he basically was like, stop, just stop that, Mr. Secor, with all your burning intensity that makes these people tell the truth about their biases. And then he tried to do it a little bit. And then he kind of gave up and just let Casey and us, to a lesser degree, do our thing. But you're right, the state of voir dire, I mean, should just be like a Trump rally where everybody just gets to say what they want and expose who they are. I mean, I know other states have more attorney-conducted voir dire, and unfortunately South Carolina does not, unless it's capital. We still push for it, but it was crazy. We had a murder trial last year where everything was fairly normal about it, except our client was very obviously gay, and that was going to come out a lot in the case, that she, you know, had to fight off this attacker that was, for kind of revenge reasons, was wanting to rape her, and so she killed him. And there was a lot of problems with the case, but the prosecution, I mean, it was just this kind of, as you say, educational voir dire. And we just wanted to make sure that the jurors didn't have any, you know, affiliations with the defense or prosecutors, and everybody can be fair and impartial, right? Of course. And I was like, well, that's, Judge, we have to ask a question. If any of these folks out here, are they going to not be fit, or just simply because she's gay? We have to ask this question because they're going to find out about it just from the evidence. Prosecutor fought like hell to keep it out. And finally, the young judge was like, all right, I'll throw you a bone. It probably doesn't matter.
He screwed us on something else, but gave
us. So he asked this. He's like, all right, fine. Follow up. Okay. Just to, because the Sheilas wanted. Can any of you feel like, you folks out there, feel like you can't be fair and impartial if you learn that, you know, Sheila's client is gay? And it's like half the whole courtroom was just like it. And so we were like,
to bring another panel in.
We're like, holy shit. And so we struck like 20 people for cause who were just like, nope, I don't care what the evidence is. You know, she's immoral. And I will never listen to anything that comes out of her mouth. And so thank God we asked for that question. But that was like, it was just like the judge is throwing us a bone. But it was the one question that wasn't, that was allowed, that wasn't your basic, hey guys, let's all be good. Let's all sit here and be fair. Okay. Wink, wink. And so, I mean, so many people are getting screwed all over, and thankfully, at least because of the constitutional cases you've referenced, at least when the stakes are the highest of the high, that you can get that. But when it's just 30th of life, you know, you might just get your bumper sticker questions.
Yeah, well, that's an incredible story. I hadn't heard that y'all pulled that off, and I think that's fantastic. And I hope you have a transcript of that voir dire, because I would attach it to a motion for future requests for attorney-conducted voir dire, because it's a perfect example and a concrete example of how all these things that judges think don't matter really do. And the thing that we really harp on in voir dire, which I think is something that everybody should be doing, is that there are two distinct oaths for jurors. There's an oath for prospective jurors, and there's an oath for seated jurors. And the seated juror oath, meaning if you're actually picked to be one of the 12 people in the box, that oath talks about how you have to be fair and impartial, follow the law, and render a true verdict according only to the evidence that you hear in court. The voir dire oath for prospective jurors, meaning all the people that come in for jury duty, the only oath they take is to tell the truth when they're asked a question. That's it. And the idea of that you can ask people, can you be fair, and that anyone's going to say no, is just fucking absurd. Everybody thinks that they're fair. Even hardcore death penalty proponents who are definitely going to give somebody the death penalty think of themselves as fair. They're like, yes, I will wait until the end of the trial and then give him the death penalty. That's their version of fairness. And so it's really important, I think, when we're trying to convince judges to allow us to do what we need to do and what is constitutionally permitted, is to say, why would we have this oath that asks them to tell the truth if we're going to ask them these meaningless questions like, can you be fair? If that's the standard, we could just have somebody from the clerk's office stand in the parking lot and ask them before they come into court. We don't have to waste time bringing them inside. But if we're going to ask them meaningful questions, we have to do so in a way that allows them to speak their mind about the issues pertaining to the case. And so that's the crux of what capital jury selection is all about, is asking them hard-hitting questions and reminding them all they have to do is tell the truth. There is no right or wrong answer. Whatever they say will be honored and respected by every single person in the courtroom, and that you're not trying to trick them or get them to contradict themselves. But the point that I always bring up to judges, when judges want to say, well, I asked them if they could be fair and impartial, and they said they could be, I don't understand what the problem is. The analogy that I always say, because a lot of judges, like, I just think don't understand it. And what I always say is, judge, can you imagine if when a 16-year-old went to the DMV to get their driver's license, can you imagine that the standard was that they walk in on their 16th birthday and someone at the DMV says, can you drive? And they say, yes. And they say, well, here's your driver's license. Have a nice life. Can you imagine that was the standard? There would be blood and guts splattered all over every highway in the country if that was the standard for getting your driver's license. Because the standard is, can you drive? But we don't outsource that decision to 16-year-olds. We ask them questions about driving, and then some expert decides if they can drive. That's what the judge's role is. The judge during voir dire is the DMV. And so when jurors come in, the standard to be determined is, can this person be fair and impartial? But asking them that is absurd. It's as absurd as asking a 16-year-old, can you drive, and then giving them a license. What judges don't understand is that the fair and impartial standard is a legal determination that they have to make based on the totality of the jurors' answers. So we should get to engage with the jurors about their deeply held beliefs, and then the judge, with their brilliant judge mind, should sit there and say, can this person be fair and impartial? That's how it works. But for some reason, judges don't get that. Similarly, the standard for getting somebody qualified as an expert in court is like, do you have specialized knowledge, experience, or education? And you have to establish that via testimony. Can you imagine the state put somebody on the stand and said, do you have specialized experience, knowledge, and education? And they said, yes. And the state was like, well, we tender this person as an expert. Be like, no. That's a standard that you have to meet by asking this guy questions about his education, about his experience. And then the judge will decide if you've satisfied the standard. We don't just ask people the standard and accept their answers verbatim. That's fucking stupid.
That's such a great analogy. Can you drive?
He's the king of good analogies.
Mitigation impaired. Man, that's great. Well, guys, I don't want to always have the reference point be the Cruz case, but I will just say, you know, what's on your horizon? I mean, I know there's a lot of teaching going on for Suzerain. I know, Casey, you're and Kate, you've got some cases you're working, but where do you want to be? I mean, what do you want to do with, you know, any energy and motivation you have in the next couple years? What are your hopes? And do you like the teaching aspect and kind of getting on the ground and kind of making that kind of umbrella impact? Or do you feel like you still have a role to play on tough cases where people want, you know, the team that helped defend Nicholas Cruz?
Yeah, I still have several cases. I intend to maintain private practice. My dream would to be spending half of my time doing training through Suzerain and half of my time doing casework. I'm sure there will come a point when I'm tired and I don't want to be in the field anymore, but I feel compelled to stay in the field. I always want to have clients and have those connections with my clients and their families. I think it's important for me to stay in touch with and up on changes in the mental health field, and for all of us to understand what's going on in courtrooms, sort of the culture that's out there, what the prosecutors are doing, what the judges are doing, keeping up with the obviously new case law. So Casey and I would like to have some cases together. We're actually both starting trials on the same day in two different states coming up at the end of April, unfortunately, but I certainly enjoy the ability to go out and do these in-house case consultations. I like them more than the large group lecturing, but I think that both are necessary tools that we have as Suzerain to help people.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest problems facing capital defense, the capital defense community right now, is there is a tremendous experience and knowledge gap between the generation of capital defenders who've sort of been trying cases for the last 20 to 30 years and the lawyers are going to have to be trying them for the next 20 or 30 years. But during the Obama administration, I think we collectively felt as a community that the death penalty was on the way out, that we could sort of see on the horizon that it was going to end in the relatively near future. And when Trump beat Clinton in 2016, that calculus changed radically. Trump's appointments to the Supreme Court, I think, have extended capital punishment in this country, I hate to say it, but probably beyond my lifetime. And so because there was this expectation during the Obama administration that the death penalty was sort of on its last legs, there was not enough put into the training of the next generation of capital defenders. And so I believe very strongly that the program that Suzerain is running now, our capital consultation program, is the type of program that is so necessary to ensure that the next generation of capital defenders have the tools and the education and the experience they need to continue carrying this torch forward. And so I'm incredibly proud of what we have done, but we need to do it more, and we need to expand people's knowledge of the availability of Suzerain's consultation team. We have an incredibly benevolent couple who has donated money specifically for us to conduct capital consultations so that we can go to work with offices that do not have the money. And those are the people that we are wanting to help the most, because needless to say, anybody who is facing a capital murder charge is in a very bad situation. And having a legal defense team that lacks the resources and the experience and the knowledge makes that situation exponentially worse. So I, like Kate, believe that going forward, that teaching and educating the next generation is crucially important. I do always want to have part of my practice be representation, because I do not think that you can properly teach people unless you are doing the work yourself. So I believe in order to keep myself a legitimate teacher, I need to continue doing this work, at least to some extent. There are times that I love my job and times that I absolutely hate it and wish that I could do virtually anything else. And I frequently think to myself, you know, how much I would love to be one of those people who works at Home Depot, you know, and just wear that orange smock every day and just tell people where the batteries are and all that kind of stuff. Like I envy those people. I really do. And I don't mean that in a very genuine way. I envy people who find satisfaction in that type of work. And I believe that I would too, but I've gotten myself involved in this job that I do believe is very important. And there are not a lot of people who are interested in doing it. And so I take a great deal of pride in what I do, but it is not a career that is going to lead to happiness. It's not a career that's going to lead to any kind of financial stability. And frankly, it's not a career that, done long-term, is known for engendering mental health in a positive way. So maybe someday I could see myself practicing law outside of capital defense. And I would love to do more cases with the two of you guys, and would love to do cases with Kate, even if it were non-capital cases. But for the time being, as Kate said, we both have trials coming up. We just got to kind of stay the course.
Well, to the two or three viewers that we have routinely, we know that they are very wealthy.
Live. A lot of these have.
And I would encourage them all to donate to Suzerain. It is a very obviously worthwhile group that needs everyone's support to continue basically doing human rights work. And we're going to donate some money. We've got a new HVAC that needs to come into this old building tomorrow. As soon as that check clears. Got one for you, buddy.
Well, I appreciate that.
It is very easy to donate to Suzerain. Our website is szrn.org, and there's a little button that just says donate, and all you have to do is click it and then pick a high dollar amount.
Yeah. And I think one of the mistakes that I've made is that I've been extraordinarily transparent about what Suzerain does, because the crux of death penalty defense is the representation of guilty people. I have had clients that I thought perhaps weren't guilty of first degree murder or capital murder, but I have never had a client that was innocent. There are, of course, sadly and tragically, a relatively small number of people who have been sentenced to death who were factually innocent. And I think that is absolutely horrifying. One of them was in South Carolina. I believe it was George Stinney, who was executed at age 14. And thank goodness, for whatever it's worth, he was posthumously exonerated by Judge Mullen. But what we do is defend the lives of, for the most part, guilty people. And if you look at other organizations that do death penalty defense and you look at their websites, you could come away with the impression that most of their clients are innocent. And, you know, representing innocent people is admirable. But I think that all these organizations that appear to be representing a lot of innocent people, they might have a couple innocent people, but the vast majority of their client base are people who are guilty. And so I try to be very open about that. Perhaps I should pretend that all of our clients are wrongfully accused and innocent, but that, to me, that's a little bit intellectually dishonest. So I do believe firmly in the constitutional principles that this country was founded upon, and I believe that those rights are not worth the paper that they're written on if they don't apply to poor, guilty people, because innocent privileged people very rarely need to assert their constitutional rights.
Well, Casey and Kate, thank you so much for being here and, you know, lending credibility and legitimacy to our humble podcast and being our first invited guest to come talk a little bit. Now we can go back to slinging our trash and our back page article discussion, but we just appreciate you guys talking about such an important subject in the law and kind of from just a human perspective as well. And we appreciate you so much.
So much.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yeah. Thanks for having us. I've got a know a guy that has another podcast based on public defender, criminal defense work. And Kate and I were on his podcast, but he's asked me for recommendations about other people. And I was going to send him an email recommending that he have y'all on to specifically talk about the Castle Doctrine. Is that something y'all would want to do?
Sure. Love it. We can do that. All right, guys. Thank you so much. Thanks for your time.
Yeah. Thank y'all very much. Take care.